Jó reggelt kívánok. Good morning to everybody. We will speak in English. My name is Csaba Sógor, MEP from Romania. And I'm coming from a region where people still used to farm in an old traditional way. For me it's quite normal. Also it's quite normal traveling by car to my constituency to see sometimes wild animals, even bears on the road. But for many Europeans it's not anymore a normal thing. Today we will discuss about the place of the high nature value farming in the common agriculture policy. And I will present my panelists. Around 11 there will be a Spanish speech from our Spanish colleague Garcia Perez, but there will be translation on channel number 2 in English. And at 12 we need to leave the room, so I will be a little bit strict with the time. And first let me introduce Mr. Borna Tancor, State Secretary for Agriculture in Romania. After his presentation will follow my colleague George Lion Mep, and then László Demeter, Fogányhavas Association, and Sapienza Hungarian University from Transylvania, Romania. And afterwards, Paul Walton, Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And then at 11, our colleague Garcia Perez. And after Guy Beaufoy, European Forum on Nature Protection and Pastoralism.
Did I pronounce well? Yep.
Okay, thank you. So I give the floor to State Secretary, Mr. Borna Tancos.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. My name is Borna Tancos, Secretary of State in the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development in Romania. I'm coming from the same region as Mr. Sógor, and I can tell you that I know very well what means the high natural value farming in Romania and in our region, in Transylvania, in Szekeland. We have to understand that in Romania we have a huge potential of high nature value farming and other green approach to agriculture. However, the lack of formal measures to embrace such type of exploitation are forcing farmers of high nature value farmers to the age of subsistence. In contrast with other industrialized countries, in Romania we can see that a lot of farmers are still using the old traditional forms of farming, not always as they not use this type of farming because they want to choose this type of works, but in a lot of cases they don't have other option because of the lack of capital, because of lack of knowledge, because of the last 20 years of unfinanced agriculture. As you will see in the next presentation, in present in Romania we have different types of subsidies, subventions for these farmers. And the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development understood that this is a complex system and you cannot speak about high nature value farming as an entity which is not linked to other measures, which is not linked to other type of rural development subventions. The policymakers, as I said, recognized that high natural value farming must be included in the National Program for Rural Development 2007-2013, and I will present you how we try to help these farmers to develop their farms, but to convince them to keep this type of world, this type of methods and farming. Some key characteristics of the high nature value farming systems, not only in Romania but in the whole Europe. In Romania, are available to, we are discussing about moderate use of agrochemicals, low degree of industrialization and technology use, breeds adapted to the local environment, high labor intensive, and most of the farms are small or micro farms, and subsistence and semi-subsistence farms are characteristics of this type of farming. If we are, if we take a look of the statistical approach, we can see that in Romania, 87% of the total area is located is delimited as rural area, and 45% of the population, it's a huge percentage of the population, are living in these areas. And what is a gap or an advantage of the Romanian agriculture and the Romanian rural development is that we have more than 4 million farmers. Farmers in the sense of landowners, in the sense of people who are working with different type of technologies and they are involved in agricultural activities. Probably we cannot compare these farmers with the farmers in the north part of Europe, but we are discussing about a lot of millions of subsistence and micro farms or some semi-subsistence farms. In Romania, probably because of this type of these characteristics of the agriculture and rural development, we can see that the high natural value farming is not yet fully developed, and it can be considered that many farmers using this method without knowledge, knowledge about high natural value farming. And we can see that a minimum of 3 million hectares of Romanian agriculture land can be classified as where it is most likely that high natural value systems are present. And of course, we are discussing in the same time about lands which are favored areas in Natura 2000 or national protected areas or are in specific environmental conditions. If we want to analyze the connections between high natural value farming and different rural development measures, we can see that it's very important the semi-subsistence farming role and the semi-subsistence farming measure in a high natural farming system, because this subsidy, which is which means 1,500 euros per year per farmer, is a very important income for the small farms. The subsidies, the payments for less favored areas, which will be presented in the future, are playing a very important role too in this system. And the agri-environmental payments, especially the ecological agriculture, is very, plays a very important role in this system. For instance, we have a very good experience related to high nature value farming payments for this 5-year contract, because even if the landowner is changed, this contract for 5 years is kept, and everybody is trying to convince the new owner to keep the measure, to keep the conditions, and to do not pay back the monies to the ministry. In the other part, we can see that measure 312 for small and medium enterprises in the regions, in the rural regions, it's very playing a very important role in the system, because, as you know, the high natural farming is not profit oriented, or even if it's profit oriented, but cannot assure a high level of incomes for the farmers. And this is why the small and medium enterprises playing a very important role in these areas. A lot of farmers are involved in high natural value farming as a complementary activity, and they need a basic activity in another area, and they need a good salary, incomes to assure a high life quality in rural areas. The agritourism could be a very good market for the products which are coming from this kind of this type of farms. Probably the situation is similar in any other country in Europe. It's very difficult to go with these products in the big supermarkets. But if we can develop agritourism in these regions, in these areas, this could assure a good market for these products from high natural value farms. Another important measure, which is linked and has a good, an important rule, it's a mistake, it's not 1-2-2, it's 1-1-2, young farmers, for the young farmers, measure for the young farmers. We have to help these young farmers, and we have to transfer knowledge to these young farmers for everybody to understand which is the importance of high natural value farming in these areas. If you have a short look on Romania's map, we can see that almost the whole region of the whole country is covered by high natural value system. We have three types of these areas. And if you're discussing about the less favored areas, you can see that these three packages, two measures and three packages, has a very important role in high natural value farming, farm development. We have this amount of money, 100 euros per hectare for mountain regions, 24 for other regions, 80 euros per hectare in Danube Delta. It's a specific region in Romania. And the same subsistence farming is a very important rule, as I said. We have 85,000 farms in the system now, and we are paying year by year 1,500 euros for each farmer. The agri-environmental payments, these five packages, the most important is the first one, high natural value grasslands, 124 euros per hectare. And the last one, the ecological agriculture, we have a completely new system approved in 2010, and it's very important for our small farmers. Some details about the grassland payments and the future challenges for Romania and probably for the whole Europe in this point of view. High natural value farmers are often socially marginalized. The contribution to the natural value is very important, and we have to support them. And the lack of cooperation between the farmers where we have the leader system. We can use it, and we can improve this cooperation between the farmers, and we have to ensure them a good market for their products. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. My colleague George Lyon is coming from a region which is very similar to ours. It's the Transylvania side of Great Britain called Scotland. And I give you the floor now to speak about the place of high nature of valley farming in the gap.
Thank you very much. I'll be relatively brief. What I intend to do is speak a little bit about this, about some of the challenges that we face in Scotland, where 85% of our land is designated as LFA area, which I guess you could equate to high nature value farming, and then speak a little bit just about the challenges, the policy challenges going forward and where the debates are as we go forward. In Scotland, we're actually in some ways probably the complete opposite of the Romanian situation just described. We have 85% of the land designated LFA, but by and large, the majority are a combination of big, big, extensive farms with sheep and cattle on them, grazing rough moorland with some what we would call in-by grassland areas, and the crofting areas, which are, as it's quite often described in Scotland, small pieces of land surrounded by huge amounts of regulation, basically 1 in 2 hectares. Usually the type of crofting enterprise is someone with an off-farm job who has some cattle and sheep and through the combination can earn a return from that keeps them, gives them an income. And in Scotland, some of the challenges we've saw over the last 20-25 years has been firstly a decline in the number of people living in these areas, because it's by and large the bulk of our population lives in the cities and the rest smaller numbers live in rural Scotland. But we've seen a decline in sheep numbers, sheep and cattle numbers as well, and we've seen big amalgamations of units. We've also had the debate between the conservation agencies and the RSPB and the farming industry about which is the right direction to go in. And it was a very confrontational discussion way back in the 1980s when it first started about what high nature value farming was and how you did it. And I do remember on the island of Islay, where there was a RSPB, Royal Society of the Protection of Birds, bought quite a significant numbers of the farms there and brought all these so-called experts, environmental experts, in to run them. And there was huge conflict with the local farming community. And it took a while for them to understand, actually, you had to go with the farmers, and farmers were an integral part of delivering not only agricultural output, but the environmental and conservation goals. And it's taken quite a number of years, but there's now an absolute recognition, I think, between those who are interested in preserving bird life and preserving the conserving the natural environment and those who live and work on the land, that you cannot do one without the other, and they go hand in hand. And one of the big steps forward, I think, has been recognising that instead of using the big stick approach, where it's rules and regulations, that if you actually incentivise, then farmers buy into this whole agenda of high nature value farming and the need to not only produce livestock but also to conserve the landscape, to preserve the bird life, etc., etc. So, and that's the approach I've always had to reform of a common agricultural policy, that the stick is not the right approach, that actually designing incentives that actually put a value on some of these goods is the right way if we want to deliver both these agendas. The biggest, I think, change that we have seen in Scotland in the last 7 or 8 years is the decoupling of payments from production. And what it has resulted in is quite a substantial decline in cattle and sheep numbers. And there's real worries that certainly as cattle disappear off the hills, they become unmanaged, and over and undergrazing now is a big problem, where the heather is actually becoming too strong because it's not managed well enough, that we need cattle to manage them. And there's a real discussion about how we actually tackle that in Scotland. What are the policy tools that we can use to deliver that? And I'm not sure whether that reflects the wider debate across the rest of Europe. But that's certainly been the debate back home. And therefore, if we are going to maintain high nature value farming, if we are going to keep people living and working in the rural areas, delivering not only some local food for local communities, but also preserving the environment and conserving the bird life, then we need to make sure that we keep people and we keep cattle and sheep production in these areas. And that's not going to be easy. Thankfully, we've seen the levelling out of the decline in beef and cattle number and beef and sheep numbers in Scotland, because prices have improved, and that seems to be its levelling out, and we might actually see people starting to reinvest again in putting cattle and sheep back on the hill sides, which are so important in maintaining them. So, looking forward, the big debate is in CAP reform is clearly the budget, I guess, is the first one. How big is the CAP budget going to be, and what's it going to be used for? And we heard the rumours last week coming out of the discussion in the Commission on the budget, where they're trying to sign off the document that will be published tomorrow, that Barroso had proposed a 30% cut in the rural development budgets going forward. Now, that would be a very, very big cut, and very difficult to see how you could continue to fund the LFA schemes and the agri-environmental schemes that I think are so important to the future of high-value nature farming. The other debate around this whole issue has been the debate about what you do with the direct payments going forward, and again, in budgetary terms, there's been a big push for the new member states to see a greater share of the direct payments budget. There's also been an equally big debate about this idea of targeting of the direct payments, moving away from the idea that it's just a blank income check and that there's no public goods attached to it whatsoever. An attempt, I guess, to answer the question is, what are uncoupled direct payments for? Because they're no longer linked to food production. So what is it the general taxpayer and the public get back from the huge amounts of money that go in? Clearly, income support is still one of the answers to that question, but not the whole answer. And therefore, there is the debate about the targeting of direct payments, the better targeting, where you've actually attached some public goods to them. And I think the key ones for the future of LFA areas and high-nature value farming is the ability, certainly, I think, to use coupled payments where necessary, albeit within WTO limits, so that we can keep cattle on our hill and upland areas, which are so important. And I do think we need to retain that option. I also believe that the direct payments, you should be able to target them at the LFA areas. And unfortunately, in the DES report, which we voted on in Parliament last week, that idea was kicked out, but it's certainly still in the Commission's proposals. It seems to me that if you ask what the direct payments are for, surely it's to support less favoured area farming, and given that less favoured areas cover 54% of Europe, I would think that the ability to at least top up and direct some of them payments there, and I hasten to add, this is not about reducing the payments in the rural development. This is about an additional payment. Unfortunately, that notion in Parliament certainly didn't command enough support to get through the plenary session of Parliament on last Wednesday. But it's still in the Commission paper. It's still there as part of the targeting agenda, and I hope it does succeed in that. We've also got the green component now that's been talked about, and what does it actually do? What does it deliver? And there are various ideas you've seen from the Commission where Natura 2000 should be included in it. The Commissioner's talking about organics being where you qualify for that as well. Green cover was in originally. I'm not sure it's still there. The extension of permanent pasture land was in there, extending the lifetime of permanent pasture. So there's a range of tools in there. But I think that in terms of the direct payments, I think it's too blunt a tool to be able to actually address properly the whole greening issues that we need to do. I think they should be done through rural development, because they are, in a lot of ways, they are national and regional when you're talking about where ag and environmental schemes should be, the LFA schemes as well. I do believe that the greening component should be very firmly firmly focused on tackling sustainability of agriculture, because that is the single biggest challenge we face. How do we actually improve output while at the same time reducing our energy use or the use of all the scarce resources, water, land, etc. And I believe that that's a much better fit for the green component than looking at some of the support tools that we need for high nature value farming and LFAs, apart from the ability to target LFAs with a top-up right at the very top. The Pillar 2 debate, I believe that's where the right tools lie. We need to make sure there's enough resources there to be able to do the job, of course. And certainly in the UK and in Scotland, there is a huge shortage of money to be able to deliver decent programmes there for historical reasons, and I do hope we do look at fairer distribution of the rural development package across Europe this time round. So I think I've said more than enough, and be happy to answer any questions there is. But the big debate, I think, is still round A, the size of the budget, and then the tools that are within it that will support LFA production across Europe. Because if we leave the market to decide where the production takes place, it certainly will not be in LFA areas. And if you see production of cattle and sheep is lost to the hill and upland areas, then you will lose all the benefits of high nature value farming, and you'll lose the rural communities that are so important in these areas and the ability to produce local food for local communities. So there's an absolute underlying fundamental political need to make sure that the tools we do come up with actually ensure that there is a bright and prosperous future for these areas. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It will be time also for questions and debate, but before that we will listen to Mr. Laszlo Demeter. There will be two member states' case studies, Romania and Scotland. So first, Laszlo Demeter, the importance of adapting CAP measures to support high nature value farming in the Pogány-Havas region. Laszlo, the floor is yours.
Dear all, it's a great pleasure and honor to be with you today from the cold mountains of eastern Transylvania we come. And three of us are here today. You can see Barbara Knows on the right. She's an English citizen, but in the last year she helped enormously our region and our organization, but the Pagan Snow Cap organization, in the field of rural development. In the middle you see Rodić Gergely, director of this association, and myself. This is our area in the Carpathian Basin, marked with yellow, so eastern Carpathians and the mountainous region with a mountain basin and a steep mountain landscape, so two different landscapes. And the red dots represent our partners in a recently established coalition on high nature value farming. And these are our organizations, part of this coalition, and some data about the size of their area of activity, geographic altitude, and population size. So you may see that there are about 50,000 people living in our areas, and about 2,000 square kilometers. A few words about our area and names that might seem unusual for you. So Pagan Snow Cap Pogány-Havas is a characteristic mountain top in our area. Cheek Basin is a mountain basin in the eastern Carpathians, and the name comes from the weather fish, interestingly, because this fish was very, very abundant in the marshes along rivers in that area. And Dimesh, ethnographically very famous area, the name of which comes from deer, so Deer Valley we could translate. And there are some pictures about our area. In the background, the highest mountain is the Pogányhavas, pagan snow-capped mountain. And in the middle, you see a Catholic church with these very pagan mural drawings, medieval drawings, including some important creatures for us, wetland and now highly protected, rare, relatively rarefied species. This is the mountain area of our study, yes, of our interest, Dimesh, which is a very steep countryside, which makes mechanization almost impossible. And another picture about the flat landscape with the weather fish. And this is the fish itself, our godfather. I would like to talk to you about the scale of small farming and the services provided to the European society to understand better what is HNV farming. Because there are big differences, although HNV farming is present all over Europe, but there are big regional differences. So there are about 3.5 million small farms in Romania, which is the largest within the European EU. And these farmers and farming communities created and continue to manage so-called high nature value farmland, and especially HNV grassland. And this is considered good for both biodiversity and human society, because these activities, agricultural activities, not only provide food and other saleable products, but services like maintaining soil, reduce erosion, filtering water, protection from flooding, pollination, carbon storage, very important in our days of climate change, protection against pests, agricultural pests and diseases, biodiversity, very importantly, including genetic and ecological diversity, cultural heritage, because these practices, these traditional farming practices, are not taught in schools, but mostly inherited through generations and through time. So they are very similar to medieval practices. And so far, this was considered a sign of backwardness. But now, luckily, we start to acknowledge and understand the nature value of these activities and other services to society, like library of knowledge about truly sustainable. We talk so much about sustainable agriculture, but in fact, only small-scale farmers do and practice this. Although in economic terms and only money terms, currently they are not valued accordingly. And social cohesion is very important service. For example, if I have time, I will show you some pictures of whole families that make hay, and children take part in these activities and do useful work, not play in the front of the computer or hang around just uselessly. Resilience is a very important phrase and concept, and HNV farming is equal to resilience in terms of social, environmental, and economic threats. Currently, HNV farmers are paid for the food products that they may sell if there is anybody to buy them. But the other services are valuable, started to be compensated through the these rural development programs and through the EU, but not yet fully valued. Let's see some key features of HNV farming in Transylvania, so not only speaking about our small area, but whole Transylvania. So one key feature is that it's small. So we have to note this. Small plot size, so within the small farm, that is maybe several hectares on average or less, farm land is fragmented into small plots, and this is considered an economic handicap because it decreases efficiency of mechanization, but in terms of ecology, it provides a mosaic habitat structure and refuge for wildlife when some agricultural activity like mowing happens. And community and landscape level, we are talking not only about isolated farmers and some areas, but landscape level and thousands of people who do land management and stewardship. Low fossil fuel and chemical input, and quite the opposite, high human and animal labor input. And we have to mention the huge traditional ecological knowledge that these communities have. One of our colleagues, ethnobotanist, demonstrated, collected data that the rural communities of Dimeš, according to present knowledge, have the most detailed and largest vocabulary on their natural habitats recorded worldwide. Key features of HNV farming. So far I talked about features of HNV farming and now HNV farmland. So it is well known that it is placed to huge biodiversity, and we including genetic species and ecological diversity. These habitats that are managed by mostly by people are highly they are covering large areas, and they are highly connective and functional ecosystems too. But on the other hand, abandonment and quick ecologically damaging changes take place. For example, energy crops are planted, driven, and afforestation happens, driven by new rules and opportunities that appear in an almost random fashion. A few words about the products and problems of HNV grassland farmers in Romania and Transylvania. So there are marketable products, especially milk and milk products, meat, honey. So these are the main products, but they are the most difficult to sell. And other products like honey, jam, herbs, and handicrafts. The problems of farmers are quite big. For example, aging, that is not listed there, but finding markets where to sell their products, especially milk and meat. Because, first of all, they need a buyer, a company, a larger company, to collect and process milk. That was assured, for example, in the communist time by state, and it's now very changing and fluctuating, locally absent, for example. And another issue is too strict food safety rules that our colleagues and friends from ADEPT worked a lot to ease these and introduce more flexibility in these rules. And understanding regulation and policies is a big issue for our farmers, because if you work hard during the day, it doesn't come easy to you to do a lot of paperwork in the evening or night, because you don't have time. Access to grants and subsidies also is a difficulty for a lot of our farmers. For example, they don't fill in the eligibility rules. The rule, how we see the role of EU policies in HNV farming. So, first of all, we and the EU should create equal opportunities for small producers so that they can compete equally in the market. That means that their additional services, for example, should be compensated and paid for. Rewarding the services that HNV farmers provide society, and there are good examples and a good start from the EU with the agri-environment schemes and other agricultural payments. And these should be increased, in our view, to a realistic level. And we need, first of all, probably a change in our philosophy. So the EU official philosophy, as far as we understand, is compensating for economic loss that small-scale farmers suffer when they don't use mechanization and a lot of input. But currently, the services that they provide are not so well recognized, and instead of compensating their losses, we should reward them better than for these services. A few general recommendations from our part to increase the efficiency of rural development payments for maintaining HNV farm services to society. These could be some general principles for support system to maintain these communities. The communities who are the key to maintain HNV farmland, because we all like HNV farmland, but we have to be aware that without HNV farmers, there will be no HNV farmland either. So we need to recognize and maintain diversity. That means that we cannot set one rule and one system for subsidies and payments for a whole country. For example, in Romania right now, there is one system applied within the agri-environment payments for the whole country. So no one rule and regionalized rules are needed. We need to maintain, and policies need to maintain, landscape heterogeneity. At current, there is a certain plot size limit under which the plots are not anymore eligible for payments. So we highly recommend that these small plots are included in the system, because these are ecologically optimal habitat management forms, because they create this mosaic landscape. We need to reward non and little mechanized farming as cultural heritage and minimal ecological footprint. So in our area, non-mechanized farming is still present as opposed to most Europe. And we need to reward being small. So there are current policies that want in any way to increase farm size. For example, you are eligible to some payments if you, in a certain amount of time, increase your size. And this size does not matter in this case either. Respect traditions, and that's my final principle recommendation, that there is a huge traditional ecological knowledge in the area that should be incorporated somehow in the policies too. And our view is that farmers and historic farming communities know often better how to manage the land sustainably than, for example, policymakers. And we would like to thank our MEP Csogor Csaba for funding and hosting this event, and the other MEP host, George Lyon, and Irache Garcia Perez, and BirdLife and RSPB for helping us to organize this event, EFNCP for providing funding and for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Paul Walton.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to talk about one example of the kind of integration of biodiversity conservation with an agricultural system which is of really very significant high nature value. And it's part of that sort of movement from the debate 25 years ago that George Lyon talked about, where losses of biodiversity to agriculture were a great concern to nature conservationists, to this kind of working together where we can hopefully find a sort of sustainable and quality input to future rural development programmes under Pillar 2. This is Scottish Macker, and I'm going to talk about a LIFE project, which is underway, European Commission LIFE-funded project, also co-financed by Scottish Natural Heritage, the Statutory Conservation Agency in Scotland, and the Carlanan Eilean Siar, which is the Western Isles Council of Scotland. So this map shows the very far northwestern fringe of the EU, and right at the very edge there, the bits marked in red, are designated habitats known as Macher. Now, in these areas, we have beautiful white sand beaches. Now, this sand is largely made of particles of the shells of mollusks, of little shellfish, marine shellfish. And the rock that this is on is the oldest rock in Europe, some of the oldest rocks in the world, 3.2 billion years old, and it's highly acidic, all right? So we have acid soils, peaty soils, inundated with water coming down from mountains in the east. And then we have this sand, and there's a prevailing westerly wind blowing off the Atlantic, which blows the sand over onto these acidic soils and overlays that acid soil with a thin layer of alkaline calcium carbonate from these shells. And that mixture of physical conditions makes for an extraordinary habitat. That's what it looks like. And these pale bits you can see in the grassland there, that is wild flowers. It's very, very rich, this area, in an assemblage of wild plants, wild flowers, which is now a rare community in the west of Europe. And very beautiful it is too. It's fantastically important for some wonderful wildlife like waders, dunlins, ringed plovers, species like the lapwing, which have declined across the west of Europe and are cause for real concern. It's basically a strip of land, the Scottish Macker, strip of land 50 kilometres long, a kilometre wide, 17,000 pairs of waders. That's some of the highest densities of breeding waders anywhere in the world. And Scottish Macker is 70% of the world complement of Macker. The other 30% is in the Republic of Ireland. And that's it. That's the global complement of this habitat. And it's also important for other famously sort of declining farmland birds like corncrakes. It's not just birds, though. It's also the entire ecological community, including bees. It's very important for this. This is the great yellow bumblebee, Bombus distinguendus. This is the moss carder bee, Bombus muscorum. Both of these species associated with agricultural habitats and declining across the west of Europe. So that is the official description of Macker. Now, don't bother reading it. Okay. The point I want to make is that is the accepted European definition of Macker. And that, the bit in red, is about agriculture. Now, this is quite unusual, these formally accepted definitions of habitats by the Commission. Agriculture is absolutely central to this habitat. It's only really there because of an extensive cattle-based system which has been in place for a number of centuries. And that relationship between people and the land goes further than just agriculture. There's a profound cultural connection with this land. In the Western Isles, this is traditionally the good quality farmland. This is the desirable land, particularly when the islands were much more densely populated by people than they are now. Indeed, in many people's opinion, rather overpopulated in the middle of the 19th century. So it's a massive culture. But so when in the 1980s the BBC decided to make a soap opera, a TV drama in Gaelic, which is the language, native language of this area, they called the soap opera Macher, after the grassland habitat. This is just a quick schematic of what it looks like. So we have the beach and the sand dunes. Then just inland from that, we have an area of what we call inbay, which is arable crops. Now, these arable crops consist of 35 varieties of small oats, rye and barley that are unique to the US Islands. 35 unique crop varieties developed and evolved by the agricultural community on these islands. So that's the inbay. And then we have areas of common grazing. And the thing to realise about this land is crofted. As George Lyons was saying, it's a small bit of land with a lot of regulation around it. But crofting was originally a political response to the Highland clearances, when many people were moved out of the rural highlands of Scotland, basically rather forced emigration. And that was a huge political issue at the end of the 19th century. And what was this, these crofting laws, what they established is special rights for agricultural tenants. So crofting tenants have the right to a fair rent, they have the right of access to common grazing land for their livestock, they have the right, for example, to pass the agricultural tenancy on to family members in the future. This means that the kind of standard sort of European approach to nature conservation, which is, well, let's buy a nature reserve and manage that nature reserve for wildlife, you cannot do it in crofting areas. It is impossible because of the strength of agricultural tenancies, which has been a great thing and has allowed crofting communities to survive for over a century. But it's the kind of context where you have to work and integrate with the agricultural system if you want to do nature conservation at all. You have to work with the community. And there are changes underway. So the green bars on this graph represent the extent, the area of that traditional, unique arable, people growing arable for winter fodder for the cattle, in the 1970s, mid-1970s, and the same areas now. Basically, the area of arable on the Machars has halved in 30 years. And there's been a big loss of wildlife associated with it because a lot of these plants are ruderal arable weeds, which are rare in crops elsewhere in Western Europe. In some areas, you're getting a shift away from cattle towards sheep. This is what happens to bumblebee abundance when the cattle go and are replaced by sheep. It is a really profound effect on the bees because of a profound effect on the wildflowers. So what are the threats? There's lots of them. So we've got earlier harvesting of arable crops. We've got undersowing of arable crops, which is a new measure. We've got changes in production to deeper ploughing and away from the traditional use of seaweed as a fertiliser to use of inorganic fertilisers brought in from the mainland, which means people start using mainland seed varieties as well. We've got land abandonment associated with the loss of population. We've got problems with advisory support, skills and biodiversity planning. As I was saying, that, you know, there are problems with people getting access to computers and having time to do it in the evening, basically. Vulnerability of the local crop seed. Our project aims to, it's a four-year project in its second year, we aim to work with crofters to develop new and sustainable crofting management measures that deliver the biodiversity and the wider local benefits and complement the rural development program in Scotland and build towards the next one in 2014 to develop sophisticated and effective mechanisms that work for the biodiversity and work for the agricultural community. So that means we're working in Natura sites, we're expanding the area of arable, reducing the area undersown, demonstrating best practice, identifying constraints, and improving people's skills and support for accessing other rural development support, securing that local seed supply. We're building sheds, providing machinery, employing three people, advisory staff, coordinating. We're managing local goose schemes, which is a big part of changes in agriculture. Lots of monitoring, developing agri-environment measures with an aim to making biodiversity objectives fundamental to crofting. Research going on, we're finding out exactly what those two rare bumblebees, the two second columns here, need in terms of what flowers need, so we can tweak the management in very precise ways. So we've got lots underway, but it's not going to be sustainable without perhaps a slight shift in the greening of mainstream support, but without considerable support from Pillar 2. Without it, Europe's going to lose one of its most important areas for wildlife, but not only that, we're going to see the erosion of precious local culture and the ability of local people to provide local produce for local markets. So I'd like to thank the MEPs for attending. I'd like to thank the organisers of this, the co-funders of our project, but I'd like to thank the local agricultural community most, and the cattle as well, who are the management tools. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Iraxi Garcia Perez, she's coming from the Basque land. Unfortunately, we cannot understand this language, but Spanish is also, for some of us, difficult. So we can listen to the translation in English, I suppose, on channel 2. So the floor is yours. Thanks for coming.
Good morning, everyone. First of all, thank you very much for organizing this conference and for having invited me to participate in it. Thank you all for being here with us. Thank you for your input to the conference, which is going to be no doubt very important and interesting, and out of which we expect to have very important conclusions so that we can work on them whenever we try to draft some new legislation regarding the CAP. Because of my agenda, I would like to start by apologizing, because I'm not going to be able to stay here for a long time, but I'm going to ask you to please forward me the conclusions, or send them to me once you have drafted them, so that I can go through them and be familiar with what you have agreed. I suppose that my colleague has already talked about and thought about the work we've been doing together. That's something into which we are really putting a lot of work and time within the Agriculture Committee, and it's precisely the CAP. Last week, in this sense, we passed a new report where the European Parliament has just agreed upon the position, and they want the European Union to take different aspects into account before the new package is passed, probably in October. So I'm going to try to talk about this package, and I'm going to try to talk about this reform, but at the same time, I'd also like to talk about the quality package, because it's something which is also very important for us and something we are talking about in the Agricultural Committee. A few weeks ago, we voted upon the new report for quality produce, and I think some of the topics which were included in this report are very important for us, and therefore we should try to talk about them today. Most importantly, the environmental aspects, which we think should be crucial in future regulations in the European Union. Regarding the future of the PAC party, the Party of Socialists and Democrats, we have tried to put forward a new proposal, and we have also tried to contribute to the general discussion which we had been carrying out during the last months. And within that proposal, because we are aware about the importance of the different initiatives which had been carried out when dealing with sustainability and the environmental aspects, we have tried to include them as well. We think that any new legislation, we have to include all those aspects. We think that the PAC, the CAP, has many new challenges ahead of it, and therefore we shouldn't lose perspective. Environment is essential. We have to try to combat climate change, and that's one of the main issues we have to deal with. In that sense, we are going to have to work together, both in the European Parliament, trying to raise awareness and reflect upon new proposals, but also in the different existing organisations, so as to what's the future role of environmental aspects in Europe. We think that right now there's a sort of fight taking place. We think that there's a lack of debate within the very agriculture organizations, which do not seem to agree on the role of environment in the future, and they do not seem to agree either on how important agriculture is to preserve the environment and to fight against climate change. When I talk to all these different agriculture organizations, for example in Spain, in my home country, and I talk to them, I always tell them that the environment is not something which is harassing them, it's not something they have to combat against, but it's something they have to include within their policies because they can really benefit from it. So I think that's something which we also have to bear in mind when we talk about the CAP, and I really hope that the Commission will take into consideration all the different proposals we've put forward from the Parliament, because we are aware of the different challenges we have. One of them is environmental sustainability and climate change, as I already said before. And therefore, I think that most, if not all, of the environmental activities have to be included within the first pillar of the CAP. That's something we have already said within our report, where we said that we have to continue towards trying to go towards ecology and include new measures to make sure that the European Union provides enough funding, and the people who receive all these different funding have to always put into place ecological measures and respect the ecological rules which exist. We have also included a series of ideas and proposals as to how the different member states can put into practice the different measures suggested. We have also included a series of examples, for example, low carbon emissions or all the different emissions which can harm the environment, energy reduction and emissions, and all the different aspects. So we think the most important thing for us is that we have to include a wide framework, an inclusive framework, which all the different member states can implement according to their specific needs and their specific areas where they are located. We want that to be included in pillar number one, as I said before, and at the same time the Social and Democratic Party had also put forward an amendment regarding the CAP, which was not accepted, and that's something we're not really very happy about. It was quite sad for us because we didn't get enough support to move it forward, but we wanted all the different funding for Natura 2000 areas to be also included within the first pillar. That's something which was also very important for us, but as I said, we didn't get enough support to do it. Nevertheless, we think that the very European Commission might be in favour, actually, of this proposal of incorporating some sort of specificities for Natura 2000 within the CAP. So, as I said before, we are aware of the importance of the role of the European Parliament right now, because this is the first time where we will be able and capable of deciding or co-deciding on a very important package such as the CAP. And therefore, as socialists, we think that we have to deal with different important issues such as food sovereignty. We have to make sure that we have enough food to answer the specific needs of our population. We also think that we have to include rural aspects and agriculture as one of the main pillars which should constitute our new CAP. Because if we do not include agriculture, it's going to be very important to preserve the rural areas of the different countries. We are seeing how important that is for people living in rural areas, which are currently moving into the cities because they do not have jobs and they are not able to stay in their home areas. So I think that's something which has to be mainstreamed in the new CAP, together with the environmental aspects and ecologic aspects, which are going to be crucial for the future and which, in fact, will contribute to create a different and unique CAP which we will be able to implement in the future. there's many different suggestions. We want to include different modifications. For example, we would like to modify the first pillar to make sure that funding and all the different support which is provided to farmers is more equal and equally distributed. I mean, there's really a very big amount of suggestions and things which we would like to be included in the CAP, but I want to talk about the most important ones for us, which are the environmental aspects. And regarding the quality packets, as I was saying before, that's a new report which we passed last week within the Agricultural Committee. I imagine that some of you might already be familiar with it. So within the legislative framework of quality and of protection of denominations of origin and protected designation of origins and geographical indications, we have also tried to include new ideas because we think that right now there's a specific link to the different territories where we apply all these policies, which we have to take into account. Also, we have tried to include a new aspect, which is mountain products. That's something which many different organizations were claiming that we include mountain produce. And we have finally tried to move forward in that area, because we are aware that there's a concept, a community concept, which already defines what mountain produce is, how they are produced, and that it also says and puts forward that they are sustainable. So we thought it was something which was very practical and easy to include, and we think that's a new European brand which is very easy to be recognized and implemented, which are all these new products which are produced in an environmentally sustainable way, which are produced in the mountain areas, and which we think that precisely right now that we are trying to reform the CAP are also very important because they can also be included in the new CAP or in any future rules we try to agree upon. This is the most important things. These are more or less the most important things I'd like to talk about to you. But in any case, we're always open to comments, to questions, to proposals. Some of them we're very easily going to be able to take into account. But of course, some other proposals are not that easy to include. We have a very diverse group with many different political groups, and in that sense it's also very interesting and enriching for us to receive comments and proposals. Right now, when we discussed the new report, we, as a socialist group, have been able to reach a common position, and that's something which has happened for the first time right now, because up to now, we always had to take into account the nationalities of the different MEPs, but for the first time we have been able to achieve one single idea or to work together, and that's something which I think is very important for all of us and something where we can really benefit from, because it's precisely like that that we can really make successful changes and move forward. Right now the Commission's going to go through the report and we are going to try to move forward in this direction. We're going to try to give answers to all your needs. We're going to try to include all your requests and concerns, and I really hope that we can reach a common arena with many different ideas which really contributes to our work, our daily work in the Commission and the European Parliament.
Sorry, leaving us, but the last panelist is the guy before policy conclusions. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I feel under some time pressure to make these conclusions. But I'd like to just start by recapping a little bit on some of what we've heard. We've heard a huge amount of information and ideas. So very briefly, the first point I think to make is that when we talk about high nature value farming, we're talking mainly about livestock farming, or sometimes mixed farming, but primarily farming that uses permanent pastures and meadows, which are in a semi-natural condition. So it's farmland that's not sown and seeded and fertilized. It's, if you like, natural vegetation that's used for farming. And that's what most HNV farming is primarily about. There's also quite a lot of HNV farmland which is permanent crops, so orchards, for example, like this one in Romania. In Mediterranean countries in particular, olive groves and other tree crops that are under low-intensity farming in the Mediterranean. Arable farmland is generally not of high nature value. I think this is an important point to keep in mind, that across most of the European Union, we're not talking about arable farming when we're talking about HNV. But there are exceptions. The Macher example we heard about already, this type of very small-scale cropping in Poland in this photograph, with a lot of semi-natural vegetation between the parcels, can be of high nature value. And in Iberia in particular, there's a different sort of high nature value farming. And this picture is partly to make the point that we're not always talking about very small-scale farming. It's not always these tiny plots and very small farms. It can also be big farms, but under very low intensity, very extensive management, which is the case in this photograph from central Spain. But economically, this is still quite small-scale farming. So it's physically big, but economically, it's the incomes are small, the turnover is small in economic terms. There are a lot of common characteristics. So although the farming systems may be diverse, there are common characteristics. HNV farming is mostly taking place on poor land, so on less productive land, with less potential for high-volume production. Farms are usually small in economic size. They're often in part-time activities. The incomes from this type of farming are generally low or very low or even negative in many cases. And so a crucial characteristic throughout the European Union is this type of farming is under very severe threat of decline and abandonment. And that's not the case for farming generally in Europe. This threat is far more severe for high nature value farming. So that should influence our policy thinking. But on the other hand, there's a whole positive story, which we've been hearing about this morning, about HNV farming. So it's very rich in public goods, in biodiversity, landscape, water quality, preventing fires in Mediterranean regions. It's very rich in the quality of its products, but not in the volume of products. It's a low-carbon system, so the production and the distribution at a local level of food is a very low-carbon system. And this was mentioned already in one of the presentations, this question of the diversified rural economy, which is much more resilient in times of crisis in particular. There's employment and economic activity available at a time when perhaps mainstream economy is suffering more. So there are a whole lot of positive messages there, as well as the negative ones of the threats. The European Environment Agency has produced this map, which basically shows where in Europe these different types of farming that we showed in the photographs, approximately where they exist across the European Union. And to me, the point of putting up this map is to say, what is our future vision for farming in Europe? There's a lot of emphasis in the discussion about the CAP on competitiveness. We have to make farming more competitive. We have to produce more food. We have to feed the world. We have to export, etc. And my point here is that that may be the right way of thinking for the white areas on this map. But for the green areas, it's not really, it doesn't make a lot of sense. We can't have a strategy of increasing competitiveness and producing more volume on land that's actually physically very difficult to intensify, but also where there's a whole lot of public values, environmental values that we want to maintain and that we'll lose if we follow this simple strategy of increased competitiveness, increased intensification. So policy, the future of the CAP, needs to have a mixed vision, if you like. Alongside the thinking on competitiveness, we have to think about the future of farming systems that cannot contribute much to volume output but contribute an awful lot of other values that we consider to be very important. So, oh dear, something's happened to the slide here. So the conventional path of restructuring, rationalising, intensifying farming, which the CAP has always driven and still continues to drive to some extent, will produce, if it happens on HNV farmland, massive losses of environmental and cultural values. It will result in reduced farming employment and reduced resilience of rural economies. And yet it won't guarantee the economic viability of these farms. And we see that already with areas that used to be high nature value farming, which have been intensified, have been rationalised. Huge public investment has been made, and yet still the farming systems are not viable in a purely global competitive economy sense. So we have to think of a different path. And that path is to do with integrating the conservation of environmental values and cultural values with the development of a pluriactive farm economy. So where we have as part of our vision maintaining these environmental and cultural values. And partly that has to be through public payments for public goods, as George Lyon already said. And this will help to maintain farm employment and rural resilience. And it'll help to keep farming less vulnerable to commodity price changes. So the future CAP needs to make this alternative option available to high nature value farming and high nature value farmers. So on the one hand, that means keeping high nature value farming as one of the priorities for the CAP. It has been a priority since 2005, and that has been a very beneficial thing. So the policies we heard about in Romania for maintaining high nature value farming, which may have some detailed issues that need correcting, but basically they're a very positive policy initiative taking place in Romania, and it's in a large part thanks to the fact that that is a priority for Pillar 2 of the CAP since 2005. So we need to keep that priority. We know that some people within DG Agriculture would like to get rid of this priority. They regard it as irrelevant, but we think it has to be defended and maintained. And then alongside that, there are some specific changes to policy that need to take place to make it better adapted to HNV farming. So Pillar 1, which absorbs still most of the funds under the CAP, needs to be adapted to the needs of HNV farming. Oh dear. Thank you. So we have a technical problem. While they solve the technical issues, most of what I'm saying and what we've presented today is covered in this brochure. So the NGOs that were involved jointly in organising this seminar, we produced this brochure to explain the case studies that you've heard about and explain our policy thinking. And so these are available at the exit on the bookshelf there. So help yourself to one of these before you leave. And so if my presentation isn't recovered, then you can read it all in here. It seems like it is recovering. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so back with you. So this is adapting Pillar 1 to HNV farming needs. So these are just a very brief summary of what we propose. These very small farms that are a very important part of HNV farming, they're not just in Romania. This picture is from Spain. In Italy, I think 50% of farms are less than 2 hectares in size. So we can't just exclude these very small farms from policy. But at the moment, there is a tendency for Pillar 1 to exclude these very small farms. A simple solution we propose is that there should be a minimum payment, so that however small the farm is, you never go below this minimum payment, which could be, for example, €500 as a minimum payment for small farms. George Lyon suggested that there should be a targeted payment for less favoured areas. We don't think that's a very good approach because less favoured areas are very crudely defined, and within them there's intensive farming and high nature value farming. We propose that a much better system would be a premium under Pillar 1 for permanent pasture, which is permanent pasture under low-intensity farming, so not ploughed, reseeded and fertilised. This is quite a simple policy mechanism that could be introduced. We think it's much simpler than the Commission's ideas of agronomic packages that all farmers have to comply with, which includes permanent pasture. So a simple payment for these pastures that all farmers could get if they commit to some very basic low-intensity use of that land. A very important question is the eligibility for Pillar 1 payments under the CAP. This is a major issue at the moment in some countries. So pastures like these in the photograph that have trees and shrubs, which is a very important part of the biodiversity of these pastures, they're excluded by the CAP rules from getting Pillar 1 payments. So we're condemning this type of HNV farming to abandonment because of the rules that the Commission applies as to what type of land can get Pillar 1 support. A variant on this problem is landscape features like hedges. So in many HNV areas, you have very large hedges. This photograph is from Northern Ireland. But the European Commission has some very rigid rules about how big a hedge can be in order to be counted in the eligible area of a farm for Pillar 1 payments. So we're getting this kind of thing happening in some parts of Europe where farmers are cutting down their hedges to meet the rules in the European Union rule book. They have to be 2 metres wide and they can't be 5 metres wide. So we want to get rid of these rules. They don't help anybody. And for Pillar 2, agri-environment is extremely important for high nature value farming. These measures are very necessary and need to be developed more. So we need more agri-environment, certainly not less. Some countries need to be much more ambitious in their use of agri-environment schemes. The coverage at the moment is incredibly patchy. Some countries do a lot, but some countries do almost nothing with agri-environment to support high nature value farming. And we need to see more focus on agri-environment, on supporting the farming system, and not just on measures that pay farmers to do certain practices for certain species. And our final proposal is that Pillar 2 rural development programs should include a specific funding measure for the type of projects that we've actually heard a bit about today. So the Machia project in Scotland, the Pogani Hovash project in Romania. There are quite a lot of projects like this around the European Union. And things like CAP payments, Pillar 1 payments, agri-environment are all very necessary. But it's these local projects, these proactive partnership projects at a local level that really make the big difference. That's when farmers, nature conservationists, policymakers can really come together and make a big difference. And yet these projects are almost never funded by the CAP. They're funded by LIFE, by private money, by NGOs. We need to see the rural development programs of the future providing funding for these types of local partnership projects to support high nature value farming. So like I said, for more information, read the brochure, look at our websites, and I hope we've got time for some discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Since we are a little bit running out of time, now we still have a little bit time for questions or remarks. Unfortunately, my two colleagues left at the life in the European Parliament is always very busy, so put your questions for the remaining panelists. And if you still have, you'll have some time at the end, Mr. Demeter will show us a short film.
Sections from a film, so describing biodiversity and traditional
in our area.
If there are still no questions, so... Oh, okay.
So, yes. Okay. Nat Page, Adept, Romania. I was just very struck by what Mrs. Garcia Perez said about shifting things to Pillar 1, and I just wondered if you had any feeling for how things will, what the balance of argument is within the CAP, and you particularly, I think, can answer this, in terms of how it's seen in Brussels, because shifting of the agri-environment or of green support to Pillar 1 is okay to some extent, but it's very dangerous, isn't it? Because the big farms will continue to get most of the money, and we all know that in practice, under Pillar 1, the small farmers will not be supported as they should be. And do you see a big danger in shifting funding from Pillar 2 to Pillar 1? And that's the first question. And secondly, capping payments. Are you aware of any arguments that farms will have limits, upper limits on the payments they receive? Both that would be quite helpful for the small farmers too. Thank you.
BirdLife International, Ariel Bruno. I have two questions, mainly I think for the State Secretary, particularly about the positions we can expect from Romania and maybe also from other new member states. One really follows on the issue that Nat has raised. We know there is right now a big attack against Pillar 2, and the impression is that a lot of the member states are really interested much more in maintaining the big chunks of untargeted subsidies in Pillar 1 than they are interested in Pillar 2, despite all the evidence that Pillar 2 is where we are really able to get the sophisticated delivery and also those win-wins for the environment and rural development and marginal communities and the rest of it. I would argue that particularly for a country like Romania, standing up and speaking for Pillar 2 makes a lot of sense. Can we expect a courageous position on this? And the other question is on the issue of the eligibility criteria. I mean, we know there are particularly regions in Romania and Bulgaria where in some cases more than half the farmland, especially the grazelands, are excluded completely from the CAP, Pillar 1 or Pillar 2, because of all those stupid rules. Now, we know that we are having a very, very hard time in the Commission to get listened to it. The Commission is working pretty much on the ethos where all those things with trees are not real agriculture, all those small people doing funny things in the mountains are not real farmers, and the whole thinking is exclude as many of them as possible because this will simplify, rationalize, reduce the error rate, and so on and so forth. So we really need a push, and I think, again, Romania can be one of the countries that can push back and say, wait a moment, the policy needs to achieve objectives, environmental and social objectives, and if we need to bother with messy land and messy people to achieve those objectives, we actually need to do it. What do you think?
Thank you very much for your question. Honestly, we have a huge debate in Romania regarding some aspects of CAP, but regarding the pillar two, we don't have any question. We are for maintaining pillar two. It's very important for our small farmers. It's very important for farmers which have a possibility to get in parallel with pillar one more subsidies for their public services. And even if for different issues we have questions and debates in Romania, for pillar two our position is very clear. We are for and we want to maintain pillar two. Regarding the second question, in Romania we have 14 million hectares of agricultural lands. 9 million hectares are in the paying system. It means that most of the lands which are bigger than 0.3 hectares and the farm is bigger than 1 hectare are included in the system. We know that in mountain area we have some problems because of that stupid conditions, but in generally we don't have these kinds of problems such in England or in Scotland, for example. Our problems are because of small lands near the forests where the trees are too much trees, and but in generally we don't have problems with these conditions. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Gabriel Păun. I'm representing the Romanian NGO Agen Green that is campaigning for sustainable agriculture in our country. And I have a question for Mr. Tanțoș. And the question is related to what concrete measures are you willing to take to protect small farmers and biodiversity in Romania, when the minister, Valeriu Tabără himself, is working for Monsanto, the biggest biotech corporation on the planet, and he's willing to use CAP money to produce GMO protein from Roundup Ready soya in Romania already in 2012. Thank you.
Thank you for your kind question. This is very nice in politics. In the ministry, for example, there are people who are working for Monsanto, as you said, but there are people from other regions, from Transylvania, for example, for Harita country and Cheek, and we are convinced that probably in parallel, you have to sustain, you have to support this kind of farming, and you have to have measures for small farmers. For example, I don't agree with Mr. Tambor. This is a very clear position in Romania too. Regarding limits of payments per farm in the next programming period. I fully support Mr. Cioloș's position, but right now Mr. Tabără is the minister. But this is nice, and at the same time, this is the difficulty of these debates. In my point of view, we have to have pillar two. We have to have special measures, special packages for small farms, for agri-environmental methods, for young farmers, for high nature value farming, and everything what is going to be. The basis of the agriculture in Transylvania, in rural regions, in mountain regions. But normally, Romania is a big country. We have the south part of Romania, where the agriculture is completely different. We have huge farms with thousands or ten thousands of hectares of lands, where the productivity is very important, the efficiency is very important, and probably this is why Mr. Tabere is involved in such a research and such a programs. Thank you.
Just to add something, maybe NGOs should protest more. And there is a hope. There is a hope that the end of 2012, I'm sure that Ms. Tabere will be not the Minister of Agriculture.
Well, I'd like to say that in our country, in the past, was that we could make our things to that our foods, and now we are importing. And why has this happened?
Because a lot of products from imports are more cheaper than other products, and on the market we have consumers who are not for them it's not important the quality of the product, it's more important the price probably.
Gareth Morgan from the RSPB in the UK. Would the panel agree that perhaps part of the problem we've had is that we've become quite complacent about the resources that are available through the CAP, and Mr. Chollis has now made a bid for £370 billion for the next period. But the problem is Mr. Barroso wants some of this money for other things, and we need to be much clearer about what we need this support for. And this has been a great example today of the sort of areas where we need both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 resources directed, and we're going to have to make some hard choices over the next weeks and months.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Raluca Barbu, European Network for Rural Development and also collaborator of WWF Romania. I'm working on HMV in Romania for the last 5 years, I think, at least. And most of the case studies that we've done in Romania prove that most of the small farmers were not eligible for any CAP payments. So I think Romania should come. It will be about the time to come with a proposal for saving the small farmers in Romania without, which are not making the subject of the CAP framework, or to fight to include such farmers in the CAP. And second point that I would like to make is that for HMV areas, community, HMV communities actually are very important. These people have resisted and have lived in time because they lived as a community, and I think the support through CAP or without CAP should come for the community's maintenance as well. Thank you.
My name is Jan Delen of the Ministry of Economic Affairs, Agriculture and Innovation of the Netherlands, and referring to the European map of high nature value areas, we are completely white, or more or less completely white. So my question is, do you have any recommendation to countries like us, because we are so sometimes favor of our high-tech agriculture, quality standards, reaching qualities, also sustainable agriculture, but also we need to keep more effort and also more attention to nature, and to combine this high-tech agriculture with also nature management. So do you have any recommendation for us to integrate these types of approaches? Thank you.
It's quite difficult to make recommendations, but in Romania, for example, in 1989, we had a quite similar situation as you have now in Netherlands. The whole area of Romania was covered by big, big farms owned by the state, and in 20 years we solved every problem. We destroyed this kind of farms. It took 20 years but you can do it.
Sorry, we need to leave the room in a few seconds, and without any final conclusions, just to continue what State Secretary Táncos answered to the young gentleman that import food is much cheaper, just one remark from my side, that it can be done much more on local.